Transitions podcast was created to promote individual healing and growth, and to prevent or minimize the depression, anxiety, and frustration that often comes with an LDS faith crisis or awakening. It's my ethical obligation as a licensed psychologist to note that what you're about to hear may sound like psychotherapy, but it's not. It is a practical tool to help you make your journey toward authenticity without sacrificing the best parts of your life. Mormon Transitions is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and relies solely upon the support of people like you, its listeners. To help keep the podcast alive or to become a member of the community, please become a monthly subscriber by visiting mormontransitions.org and clicking on the yellow button on the right side of the page under support. All contributions to Mormon Transitions are completely tax deductible and go towards producing the podcast and building communities and programs of support for Mormons like you. Thanks for your support. Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Transitions. I'm your host, Christy Money, and I am thrilled to have Thomas McConkie on the podcast with me tonight to bring about some healing and peace for transitioning Mormons. So Thomas, thanks for coming on with me.
Thanks so much for having me, Christy. It's great to be here.
Yeah, feelings mutual. All right. So Thomas is the author of Navigating Mormon Faith Crisis and your faculty at Pacific Integral in Seattle. And he teaches classes on mindfulness locally in Salt Lake and also began hosting a podcast through KSL called Mindfulness Plus. Can you tell us a little bit more about this project?
The Mindfulness Plus project?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I got an unexpected call from KSL a couple months ago, and they said they loved my work in mindfulness and felt like I had a radio voice. So they invited me down to record a few episodes, and they liked them, and they created a podcast. So really, Mindfulness Plus, I call it Mindfulness Plus, because there is the skill and the practice of mindfulness. The plus is the side that doesn't get discussed as much, which is adult development. How does a mindfulness practice, how does the way we pay attention moment to moment, day to day, have an impact on the way we grow and develop as human beings? So I engage the mindfulness side of awareness, and I also engage the side of human development and how those two are deeply related.
Mm-hmm. They really are. And I'm glad you're doing this. We'll reach a wide audience. And that's good. And you've started a group, right? Locally. And I mean, I hear it's closed now, but you'll probably be doing more, but can you say a little bit more about that too? That class sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I just appreciate the opportunity to self-promote here. I've been hosting a mindfulness community in Salt Lake really since I moved back from China. So that was 5 years ago now. We do events all the time. On occasion, I'll do a short course, which is often 6 weeks. That just seems about the right amount of time that people are able to commit to with their busy lives. So we just started a new 6-week course, but we're planning on doing monthly gatherings starting in the fall, which will be just open to the public. It's a place where, you know, we can practice together. I use practice, I hesitate there, because it's such a common word in Buddhist circles to talk about your practice. But what I mean by that is to just practice meditative awareness, and that can be formal meditation and sitting. That can be just, you know, being present to one another in relationship and community. So I would just say there's a contemplative flavor to the events we do as a community, and they're lots of fun. Yeah, if you're in the area, I hope you can make it out. And I do workshops around the country as well. So, you know, if you want to schedule one in your area, look me up. I'd love to come out.
Yeah. I know what you mean about practice, and I wholeheartedly agree. It's like a muscle, right? And
my theoretical orientation is dialectical behavior therapy, and so as you know, mindfulness is a really important component and a skill to practice. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so tonight I want to talk about with you, Thomas, about this feeling that a lot of Mormons in transition feel that they don't fit in anywhere, or that they're in the borderlands, or they're in between. They don't feel Orthodox Mormon anymore, or they don't feel ex-Mormon, or you know, maybe they they're on the ex-Mormon Reddit sometimes, so they feel like, well, these people are interesting, but I don't think I'm quite one of them yet, or you know, it's just there's a lot of tension and stress, and so I've heard good things about your Sunstone presentation on this. I wish I could have been there.
We wish you could have been there, Christy.
I know.
You're supposed to be on our panel.
I know. twins.
Sorely.
6-month-old twins. They'll get you every time. Word to the wise out there.
Yeah. Thinking having twins, Christy. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is crazy. Okay, so anyway.
Back to Sunstone.
Yes. I have the permission from someone, a very brave soul, who shared with me her in the moment feelings about, you know, this tension of being in between, and she said I could share it in this podcast. So I'm going to read you know, kind of a stream of consciousness. You know, this is what she's thinking and feeling, and then let's see what we can do to help.
Wonderful.
Okay, here's what she says, and this is in response to as if someone were saying, "So, you know, where are you at with the church?" You know, it's just something we get a lot. She says, "Honestly, I think I'm not coming back. Who knows? I might change my mind next week, next month, next year. But right now, I'm thinking it's not going to work. I feel caught in between two worlds. There's this documentary from PBS called Amish, The Shunned, and I really related to those people who left their church a lot. There's one guy in particular that left because he just couldn't get on board with certain things, but he still lives like an Amish person by himself. He has the beard and still dresses the same and still farms with his old equipment. He doesn't feel like he fits in anywhere, and that's how I feel. I don't feel like I fit in with Mormons or post-Mormons. I'm caught in the middle, but for now I just can't make it work. I feel torn in two directions. There's a part of me that feels like I want to cling as hard as I can to Mormonism and to the only way of life I know, but the other part of me is really excited for the freedom to think for myself and live according to my own conscience. So it's been hard. I'm just not ready to own my own story yet. It's hard to explain, and I don't even really want to explain it. I'll just say this. Is there good in Mormonism? Yes, absolutely. Is it good for everyone? No. I feel like for my family, it's just not going to work. I especially can't imagine raising my son in this church. He's so much like his father, and I feel it would ruin him. Even if I wanted to crawl back into the Mormon box, I couldn't, because the box has been smashed into a million pieces. So,
yeah.
Isn't that tough?
I really appreciate that expression. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's so articulate.
Yeah, she really is. And I mean, you can feel the pain, and I mean, she's just so open and vulnerable. Thomas, I'm remembering in an interview you gave a Mormon, I think it was Mormon Stories Live, and I think Dan Witherspoon said something about how he had never felt pain or had never been hurt by the church, something like that. And then yeah. you said, well, that's interesting, because for me, like, some of the most painful moments in my life were from church. Well,
yeah.
I'm imagining.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can relate to that.
Yeah. I appreciate you mentioning Dan. I just start to smile when you say his name. I remember that very moment in that interview. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Dan just has such a beautiful spirit and a jolliness to him. Right. And I so appreciate Dan and people like Dan who weren't profoundly wounded by the church or in the church. And, you know, that's just not my story. It just so happens that the epicenter of pain in my, you know, childhood and adolescence was the Mormon church. And it, I just think it's interesting that we all come from different places that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone's journey is different. Some they haven't had that experience. I appreciate that was Dan's. I have a different story, and it sounds like you do too. And so is this woman, who is just in has been in so much pain over this being in between. So, can you tell me more about how you have found peace in that place where maybe when you were younger as a teenager you felt like you didn't fit in anywhere? What's that been like for you?
Yeah, thanks, Christy. Well, I'll tell you what's coming up for me right now when we talk about that uncomfortable space in between where we're not who we used to be, nor are we who we're becoming. We're just some uncomfortable, half-baked version of a self that's really eager to get out of the oven. I really have appreciated the framework of Robert Keegan. He's quite a well-known developmentalist at Harvard, and he talks about conflict in a really unique way that I think speaks to us in this situation, those of us who are in this situation as Mormons or not Mormons, not post-Mormons, we don't know what we are, but Robert Keegan talks about this moment in development where we shift in our orientation towards conflict from wanting to solve it. So there's discomfort, there's confusion, and we want to control the situation. We want to solve it somehow. And Robert Keegan talks about the shift in awareness, which is really a developmental shift in our ability to handle complexity and nuance and ambiguity. And at that point, he says, we move into a more receptive posture where conflict can start to solve us.
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean by that, if I can just kind of shift into my own language here.
Yes, please.
There's a really deep-seated tendency we have to panic a little bit when the body's uncomfortable, when the mind's confused. You know, it can feel, in this case, like in the Mormon transition world, it can feel like we're losing our identity. And I think, you know, frankly, we are. And so we panic and we want to kind of hold it all together, solve the problem, figure out how we got here and how we can get out because we're so uncomfortable. And what I've found to be true in my own life and what I've found to be true, you know, in community with others and, you know, even facilitating many people through this process is to release into a deeper trust in the discomfort. In other words, rather than wanting to make the pain, the discomfort go away, to open up into a more trusting orientation towards the pain and allow it to solve us, allow it to draw a new I, a new self out of, you know, this crucible, out of this situation.
Mm-hmm.
So that can sound, I hope that doesn't sound too ethereal. It's actually a very embodied and concrete experience where, you know, we just deeply feel the pain of our lives. And rather than making it go away, we open up to what the pain is telling us. You know, if going to church feels really painful and we wish it weren't painful because we remember a time when it was actually a source of a lot of security, rather than wishing that time back in our life, we actually just deeply open up to the pain and say, yeah, this actually hurts me to be at church. So what is that pain? How does that pain inform me? What does it tell me to do? And then to actually trust whatever that impulse is that arises from that pain. That's kind of what I'm talking about there.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I love it to trust your inner voice, to acknowledge the pain, to sit with it instead of you're trying to brush it under a rug. I mean, it's understandable. I mean, it feels horrible, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And it you're reminding me of you know talks that I would have with my members of my cohort, you know, people who are going through a PhD program with me and BYU's counseling center, and we're, you know, learning how to help young adults at BYU. A lot of them were going through faith crises too. I mean, it's around that time developmentally, right? You know, that time of life when you're independent. Anyway, we talked a lot about noticing and recognizing the pain and leaning into it. That was something that's always stuck with me. That idea at first was so foreign to me. It's like, why would I want to do that? But that's where you learn.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, that might be one of the most surprising things about faith crisis, about loss of identity, about transitioning, whatever we want to call it. I think it's wild. It's shocking. It's amazing that our pain turns out to be so trustworthy. The very thing that we wish we could exile or solve or wish away, you know, that turns out to be what delivers the pearl of wisdom, what catalyzes transformation. It's just incredible.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
VR, how trustworthy experience is.
I call it an awakening of sorts, you know, rather than in a crisis. I mean, it can definitely feel like one, but I mean, just from not only my own experience, but from hearing from others too that I've counseled, it's, well, and the brave woman who shared her truth earlier on, that it's exciting and thrilling and terrifying all at the same time. It's an emotional roller coaster for sure.
Right. And I think, you know, something that complicates the situation is that we often get the cultural message that if we're in a lot of pain, if we're in this phase of dissolution in our lives, that we might have done something wrong to get there. I don't want to say we always get that message, but in my experience, it's quite a common message when people are really in the depths of anguish and suffering and really mourning the loss of a former life. They'll often get the feedback like, hey, well, like, this just proves that the church is true and, like, you should be back at church, right? Mm-hmm. And that mess, those people who, you know, say that to people when they're going through that, I think have really good intentions. And yet my hope, my experience is that we're kind of growing into a new maturity as a community and learning to recognize that sometimes when we're in tremendous amounts of pain, it means that we're doing everything right. We're in pain precisely because, you know, all of our prior decisions have brought us up to the precipice of our, you know, next transformation, and that it's just necessary pain to undergo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, necessary pain. I talked with Brindis Roberts. I don't know if you met her at Sunstone. She's an amazing woman. But she and I a couple months ago talked about the difference between necessary pain, like you're talking about, and what she calls mean pain. You know, when people purposefully inflict some harm or injury, or you know, just things that could be avoided, as opposed to, you know, a part that's you know, natural human development. Like, this is, like you said, all of our decisions have been leading us up to this point in our lives that we're, you know, we're ready. You know, we're ready for the next step.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny, this is coming up right now, Christy. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just because I'm talking to you specifically, but it occurs to me that one of the greatest transformations that takes place in human life is human birth. And it's interesting that nature, God, whatever, you know, you choose to call it, it's interesting that process was designed to be so painful. Right. I haven't given childbirth myself, but here it's a painful ordeal. It's just interesting to me how beautiful a metaphor that is. And, you know, speaking to someone who recently birthed twins, you know, there is no transformation without significant pain. And we're living in a modern world where technology is so advanced. I think we live under this illusion sometimes that, you know, eventually we'll design all pain out of human life, and we forget just how life-giving, how it's pain. It's the pain of childbirth itself that gives life to life. Right? So, I mean, I don't think we can say enough about the role of pain and just coming into right relationship with it as we're transitioning into whoever it is that we're meant to become.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in that process, it's really important to be gentle with ourselves. And I'm thinking back to, the birth of the twins, and I was not very gentle with myself, especially. I felt like, well, I actually, you're probably going to get more than you bargained for with this, but I planned
it. Christy, tell it.
Really?
All the blurred details here.
All right. Well, so I planned to get an epidural because one of my twins was, he was butt first, so it could have been a complication. So they said, well, if we need to do an emergency C-section after the first baby comes, so I'd have, it would be a mess. But they said, you know, it'd be good to have an epidural so that you don't get knocked out, so that you can still be awake and you can see the birth. And I wanted to do that, so this is my first epidural after I'd already had two kids, and it started to work right away. I'm like, I don't feel anything. But then a couple hours later, I'm like, something, I'm feeling something pretty strong here. But I was kind of beating myself up like, I should have done more research into this about what could, if I was in maybe a wrong position, you know, it could hurt the chances of the epidural working. And sure enough, it stopped working, right as I was transitioning. So, uh-huh. There you go. In the transition phase, so 9 centimeters, and I was in excruciating pain. But I all this to say, being gentle with yourself, not trying to reason away, well, if I'd only done this right, or if I'd just done a bit more of this. It's I understand where it's coming from. I mean, I experienced it, very personally, for many years, this idea that well, if we can control all of the moving parts, then we can avoid pain. We can avoid this next step when just leaning into it and embracing it and being gentle, being easy, being kind to yourself can really help through the transition.
Absolutely. Yeah, a phrase comes to mind that one of my longtime Buddhist teachers uses. He talks about not just leaning into pain, but escaping into the pain, right? So, you know, just what that does when we think about escaping from pain, we don't often think about escaping into it, where we become that pain so fully that it's just an act. It's this force of nature that takes us over, and there's such a powerful transformation, that act of merging with the pain.
Yeah, that's true. Would you be willing to share an example, maybe from your own life, or just whatever comes to mind about what that process can look like on a real practical level?
Yeah. Well, in terms of merging with the pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The first thing that comes to mind, I'll just go with it, first thought, best thought. I was at a meditation retreat. It was less than a year ago. And one of the facilitators there is really skilled in holotropic breathing, which is a meditative approach with the breath and like really grounding deeply in the body and moving energy through it. And as we were breathing more and more intensely, I told the facilitator that I had a lot of pain through my chest, through my throat. It felt like it felt like acid reflux. So like it just felt like my chest and my throat were on fire and they were getting eaten by acid. And the heavy breathing seemed to be exacerbating it. And she says, good, keep breathing. Like, not back off, not, okay, good job, Thomas, go sit down. It was good, keep breathing. And I think I might have gotten really irritated for a moment. They're like, what? That's your facilitation? And but I trusted her and I went with it and I started to breathe harder and harder. And what happened after that is a bit of a blur, but I remember her standing in front of me in a very calm and supportive way. And I could see her mouth moving, but I already was having trouble hearing her. And before I knew it, I was literally screaming. It must have been at the top of my lungs, like a really kind of primordial scream coming out of my body. And next thing I knew, I was on all fours, just, it was like being a fire hose, you know, and the current of water is rushing through you, and all you can do is be the fire hose and be shaped by the water channeling through you. And like, there was just something moving through me. And I don't know how long that lasted, but by the end of the process, it might have been 5-10 minutes. By the end of it, there was just nothing left. There was no scream left. There was no fight left. The burning in my chest started to feel more like it had been coated by some golden nectar, and I just felt total peace in the body. And just, you know, went back to my room that night and laid down in my bed like a lamb. And let something go. It wasn't conscious material. It wasn't associated with any specific memory. It was just this raw energy coming out. And my first instinct was terrified. I thought, this is going to kill me. Like, you know, it's going to eat through my throat. And I'm going to die. Uh-huh. And a really calm facilitator came along and said, great, go with the trust that and see what happens. So, you know, if I can make this relatable to people listening, I don't know, if you're at a retreat and doing some holotropic breathing, then that's relevant enough. But when it comes to the specifics of our lives, I would just say that, you know, so often it feels like the pain of our situation. I talk to people whose marriages are dissolving or their careers are threatened because of, you know, their activity diminishing in the church, or, you know, what's more common, at the core of every situation, there's just a general sense of, you know, the identity dissolving. And that feels like such a big problem, because what are we going to do without our identity? What are we going to do without this self that we've always known? And there's a space in that. Again, we're back to the same theme. I think there's only one theme to talk about, really, which is that trustworthiness. That if we can really just open deeply to the intelligence of experience, the intensity of experience, and stay present to it, somehow it purifies us. Somehow it calls us into further growth, deeper awakening. It's a miraculous thing.
And so individualistic. There's really no one size fits all. There's no pat answer to, oh, well, you have a faith crisis, well, and do this and this, and you'll be great. No, I love how you're talking about, you know, trusting, going within and trusting what, you know, how you're feeling in the moment. And like I mentioned earlier, listening to that inner voice and following it, even if it's scary. Super scary.
Absolutely. And, you know, now I'm thinking of a more practical example just from my, you know, day-to-day life, and not when I'm, you know, doing primordial scream therapy up in the woods at some retreat. But I remember coming back from China, I was really surprised when I got this really unmistakable impulse and prompting to go back. There's a church down the street where I just moved in, and I hadn't been to church in, I can't tell you how long. I mean, it had been nearly 20 years. And I was really surprised to kind of get this hit, like, huh, I feel like I should go to church. And so I was confused, but I went with it. I just went with the confusion. And I got to church, and it was really uncomfortable. But I mean, like, really uncomfortable. It had been so long since I'd, you know, gone to a ward house, and I mean, I just didn't feel like I fit in, you know, talk about not fitting in. And I just sat with the discomfort week in, week out. And it started with sacrament meetings. And then I got more curious about the pain. This is the Buddhist in me coming out, like, oh, this is painful. I'm going to investigate more deeply and go into more pain. Like, 1 hour is painful. What about 3 hours?
Oh, man.
I mean, I really just explored it. And, you know, let me just add the caveat here. I don't recommend this practice on principle to anybody necessarily, right? This is just what happened to me. This was me following my mind. Yeah. Some people might be intrigued by this experiment. Mm-hmm. Some people might be repelled by it. But in any case, the point is that I moved deeper and deeper and deeper into the pain. And what I found over time, what I continue to find, because church is still, at the end of the day, it's often a painful place to me. And, you know, I could talk about why, but it still remains a painful place to me oftentimes. But what I find is that by really opening to the pain, by not avoiding the pain and acknowledging that pain comes up in these situations, I have befriended the pain in a way I didn't think I ever could. And I felt an intimacy and a reconciliation with my younger self than I thought I'd ever feel. And I felt more compassion and I felt more freedom in the Mormon culture than I thought I could ever feel. Right. And, you know, this is coming from I lived all around the world, you know, between age 19 and, you know, 31 years old. And I was doing everything I could to not be in Salt Lake because Salt Lake was synonymous with Mormonism. Mormonism was synonymous with pain. And here I am, you know, just kind of in the heart of things. And I feel a tremendous amount of freedom in knowing that whether I feel pain or whether I feel joy in a given moment, there's a part of me that's deeper than any of that experience. There's a part of me that is, you know, deeply free and at peace beyond any external conditions. And so I offer that story because I know I'm not unique that way. I know every single person listening to our conversation, Christy, and every human being for that matter, has pain somewhere. And they have two basic choices: to turn towards it or turn away from it. And I would suggest that the turning towards it, and let's go back to that phraseology, that escaping into it, it leads to a freedom that's surprising. Right. And, you know, that freedom, it might bring some people back to church. It might take some people away from church definitively. And to me, the point isn't, do you go to church or not? To me, the point is, are you free?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I hold a vision. My dream is that we help build a community of whatever Latter-day Saints, post X, Jack, whatever any Mormon calls themselves, you know, to create a community where people are free, you know, that free to express, free to worship, free to not, and that there's just an intuitive celebration of that. Mm-hmm. That's really what I hope for.
Yeah, I share that dream, Thomas. I want people to be free. And I think the pain is an amazing teacher in, you know, helping you find what your inner voice is saying, what comes next is, you know, it can't be avoided. You need to just immerse yourself in it and decide, okay, what's this pain telling me? You know, where am I going?
Yeah, exactly.
This reminds me of a Gloria Steinem quote that, you know, the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off, right? You know, that sometimes.
Off.
Yeah. So we learn from the pain, and yeah, well, we will achieve freedom, but yeah, it might piss us off a little first.
Yeah, if we're being honest with ourselves.
Yeah. I know I've counseled a lot of people who have felt that. I think it's part of, you know, the stages of grief, really. And, you know, and like you said earlier, mourning what used to be, or like you also said, that identity that we cling to, that, you know, I can't lose this, when it's like, you know, shedding skin, you know, into something new.
That's right. And I would just add to that, we don't have a lot of cultural fluency or even language categories to describe that, you know, we're mourning the loss of a former self. I mean, that might even sound far out when I say that, you know, people might be listening like, huh? But it's a real experience. And to me, it's just another way of saying transition, mm-hmm. right? When we literally feel the death, the dying off of a self that we were quite comfortable in and quite attached to. And without warning, often, you know, we find ourselves in this place where it's not livable anymore. This bodysuit, this identity that was getting us around just fine in a marriage and a church calling, all of a sudden it's breaking down on us. There's tremendous mourning that goes on. And, you know, to just raise awareness around that process and acknowledge that this is a category of human experience, and it does not need to spell your doom. It can actually just be a sign that you're growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, does not need to be a taboo subject, is not contagious. Well, and maybe it is a little contagious, but in a good way, I think. I mean, I hear some people saying, well, I don't, you know, we don't want to talk about this because we don't want it to catch, you know, for someone else to feel this. When I think, and you've talked about this before too, I mean, it's natural adult development. This is going to happen. We need better language, like you said, and more, I think, positive language. What we're talking about kind of reminds me, Thomas, I guess I'll go with this too, about changing our perspective, you know, on this transition. Kind of reminds me of my time on the Navajo Res. We lived in Shiprock. Have you been there?
I haven't been to Shiprock.
Okay, the Four Corners area. I imagine it's you've been just in that area of the world, because I know you travel and
I've passed through there. My teacher used to live close to there, actually, in New Mexico.
Oh yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. A lot of people pass through Shiprock, but people call that the city. Shiprock is the city, but you're not the country. But we had just moved from New York City, so yeah, Shiprock seemed a little small. Anyway, I'm thinking about this because I taught school with my husband. Actually, that's what brought us there. One of our fellow teachers brought in this cake, this leftover cake, and she was explaining to me how her daughter had a quinalda ceremony. Have you heard about that?
I haven't. Yeah, let me know.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's a coming of age ceremony for young women, and you know, whenever they get their first period. So it's like, it's really elaborate, and it's a really cool experience that even spans a few days. It's really positive and affirming. And at one point they bake a cake in the ground and all the women share it and celebrate with the daughter, like, yay, you know, you're coming of age. This is good. And I was like, you know, wow, if only I had something similar, something, you know, to look forward to. I think it would have gone a long way in helping me have, you know, more the sex positive and confident self image, you know, instead of being afraid, you know, of my period, this next phase, right? Because that's something also in our culture we don't really talk about, right? Right. And it's like, you know, super, except maybe people like talk about how painful it is, right? Or something to be endured. But like, wouldn't it be amazing if, you know, in our culture we would treat a faith crisis the same way as you know, these Navajo women did for this young woman?
Yes. Like, I love this metaphor, Christy. I love what you're saying. It reminds me that, you know, in our work at Pacific Integral, we look at different developmental transitions that go on in adulthood, and we're interested in a lot of different things. We're interested in the painful transitions. Like we often talk about in our research, what is the most painful developmental transition? And that's another conversation we could have. But one thing we do find is that a lot of the pain of a transition depends on the cultural context in which it's happening. And you're mm-hmm. saying that if we ceremonialized a faith transition, it was a celebration. We threw you a parade.
Mm-hmm.
You started to change. To me, that's a worthy social experiment.
Right? Like, oh, you're having a faith transition? Awesome! Like, it's something. So when I, after our time on the res, like I wanted to do something, you know, similar for my kids someday. I mean, not the exact same ceremony because, you know, I didn't want to, you know, appropriate a culture, but simply to think more about how things that would seem culturally taboo or that we don't talk about, especially for kids or young adults to just reframe that as much as I could, like even, you know, to the extent like someday my teenagers, you know, rebelling and I'm like, oh, okay. So you're differentiating from me and, you know, therefore doing right. The exact opposite of wherever I am spiritually. That's great. You know,
right.
Yeah, you're developing absolutely. Right on schedule. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I want to sound a hopeful note here. When I think up to and including adolescence, our culture has pretty good developmental intuition. You know, up till adolescence, we get that, oh yeah, you know, they're super rebellious and moody. You know, that's just being a teenager. But what I've noticed is that in the, you know, adulthood proper, in those stages, because they're more subtle, because we can't see them concretely on the surface of the person, it's harder to detect. And I think over time, we'll start to, you know, gain awareness around these subtle transitions. We start with the concrete, like, oh, you're having your first period. Let's bake a cake. Or, oh, you know, you're moody and you can't stand being around me anymore. You're differentiating. What happens when we move into the more subtle transitions of adulthood? And, well, I'll refrain from giving any examples at the moment, but you can imagine what would happen when we just learn to recognize those for what they are and to celebrate them as, you know, rites of passage. They really are that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Rites of passage. And yeah, with adult development, you're right. It's more subtle. We don't recognize it. You're reminding me of Super's lifespan theory. And at least, I mean, that's the equivalent I'm thinking of from my graduate training, that, you know, you don't just stop developing, you know, after the teenagerhood, right? I mean, that's what we're most well-versed in, right? About, yes, the rebellious phase, all that, just like you said, but, these transitions will continue to happen. And yeah, if only we would celebrate them, like, I don't know. Maybe if we're a Mormon faith crisis, we do Jell-O cake or something like that.
Well, you know, so this is, I'm going to get a little serious here.
Okay.
It feels really creative to me that you and I are talking about ceremonializing faith transition. Maybe we prototype that. Maybe we put together a ceremony and we invite the community out. This could be a thing, Christy, that mm-hmm. we just stumbled upon.
Yeah, maybe.
Imagine.
Mm-hmm. No, in all seriousness, that's why, I mean, this podcast is very practically focused, because like I know a lot of people who are in transition, they're just, you know, they want to, you know, hear about people who are going through something similar, and especially parents or future parents, you know, people are considering having kids someday. They're like, okay, well, you know, we didn't learn about this in primary, or, you know, young men's or young women's, like, what do we do now? How do we, you know, keep our kids from experiencing, you know, some of the more negative effects that could be avoided? I mean, like I said earlier, the difference, I mean, Brenda had talked about, you know, the difference between necessary pain and mean pain, like, there's going to be some necessary pain, but yeah, ceremonializing a faith crisis, I mean, that is, I think that could be beautiful for, if there are any parents out there who want to try that.
You guys spouses. Heard it here first with
yeah.
Christine.
Yeah. No, and Thomas McConkey. Yeah. Talking about period cakes. No, I'm serious. I'm going to do that too. In all seriousness. We're going to, because like I said, cultural appropriation, not my thing. I do like red velvet cake. So, you could, I'm going to, that's my plan.
Well, the possibilities are endless, but there really is, I'm inspired by this. There's something about the modern world where we've lost touch in a lot of ways with the importance of ceremony and ritual. I got to tell you, Chris, I'm in love with this idea. It would be so amazing to gather as a community and formally recognize one another as evolving beings. That it would be so powerful. I'd love to follow up with you on this and, you know, open up, to the community's creativity on this as mm-hmm. well. I have enthusiasm for it. I'll just throw my hat in the ring.
No, me too, Thomas. I'm so glad we got together about this. And yes, opening it up to the community too. And that's what I love about, you know, collective creativity and just hearing stories from different people of what they're doing, you know, now that they're transitioning and they're creating their own rituals, their family rituals. And you know, value systems now that, you know, they're in uncharted territory. Like I love to hear those stories of what people are doing, like for the holidays or, for you know, alternative baptisms or baby blessings. And so this is exciting. We should talk more.
Excellent. Well, mm-hmm. we'll plan on it.
All right. Okay, well, our time's about up. Before we end, I just wanted to talk with you a little bit about something that your book and that, you know, from what I've heard of your Sunstone presentation reminded me of, and that's when I was an undergrad and an English major, I really loved Keats, and he coined the phrase negative capability, which is, you know, the capacity of some of the greatest writers in the world to have a vision of, you know, artistic beauty or fulfillment, like even when it leads them into, you know, confusion or uncertainty, you know, like we were talking about earlier.
Right.
And that idea, as opposed to, the preference that's, you know, is understandable that a lot of people have about certainty of knowing. And I you remind me of someone who is capable of this negative capability. It sounds bad, but it's great. leave it to the romantic poets to spin something that sounds, you know, bad into something beautiful. Anyway,
say that, Christy.
Well, what do you think about this pursuing truth or beauty, even when it can lead to confusion and just that unsettled feeling, like our friend that I read her feelings from earlier on in the podcast.
Well, yeah, I appreciate getting to end on this note. It occurs to me that this, you know, when you talk about pursuing beauty, when you talk about pursuing truth, there's something deeply counter-instinctual in this move. And it's tricky territory. By counter-instinctual, I mean that at the level of, you know, just being a physical being, we're wired to respond to the, you know, pain-pleasure principle, right? We want the body to be comfortable and fed and warm and sheltered. And we want the mind to have answers we want to know who we are with certainty. We want to know what comes tomorrow, right? These are our instincts at a very deep level. When we move into faith transition, when we move into identity transition, something, a deeper identity starts to present itself. It's an identity that's more subtle than our physical being. right? And in development, we refer to subtle development, which is the territory of adulthood proper. So it's counterinstinctual to really start to open up to this confusion and to this ambiguity, to this unknowing. It creates powerful and, you know, uncomfortable emotion in the body. The mind races in confusion, just grasping for, you know, where am I and how did I get here and where am I going? If we can stay that course, if we can learn to soften into that experience, we start to swim in this new medium. We move from kind of flailing and groping to, you know, a more elegant kind of butterfly stroke, so to speak, as we're swimming in. Lorca calls these dark waters. I love the Spanish poet Lorca. He talks about the concept of duende, and he says anyone who knows duende has been baptized in the dark waters. So it's and it's so poetic. It's so beautiful because he's really vividly pointing to this experience that we come to in transition, where we lose everything. Right? We forget everything we were, and we're baptized in these dark waters, and we learn how to negotiate this new medium. We learn to swim, we learn to run, we learn to fly, and it's an amazing thing if we can trust ourselves and stay close to our experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely sense that as a theme in this podcast episode is trusting yourself.
Yeah, beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So to anyone out there who's feeling like they don't fit in, that they're in this space where they don't have that sure identity anymore. It sounds like, I mean, it's a matter of just listening, and also, you know, validation that you're not going crazy, that you're not alone either, that that so many of us have felt this way. And
and the Transitions community is about to throw you a sick parade for your developmental transition. So you got that to look to now.
Uh-huh. Yeah, this is the Ferris Bueller style, right?
I love it. The creative juice is flowing.
Yeah. All right. Well, Thomas, it's been a pleasure to talk with you tonight. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Christy.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Transitions. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us make more like it by becoming a subscriber at mormontransitions.org. Music for this episode was provided by Iris Dement.
Some say they're going to a place called glory, and I ain't saying it ain't a fact. But I've heard that I'm on the road to purgatory, and I don't like the sound of that. Well, I believe in love and to live my life accordingly. But I choose to let the mystery be. Everybody is wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody is worried.